Chapter 8, The Antebellum Era. Let me tell you a love story. Margaret Bedingall and Adam Tunno, a Charleston couple, lived in a mansion on East Bay Street from 1790 until Adam's death in 1831. Adam was a Scotsman who grew wealthy as a wine dealer. Adam and Margaret's love produced a daughter, Barbara. Adam treated both Barbara and Hagar, Margaret's daughter from an earlier marriage, with affection. Margaret and both daughters inherited substantial wealth at Adam's death. So far, a normal story of a loving couple. What is remarkable is that Margaret was a mulatto, a person of mixed black and white ancestry. Her black heritage was easily recognizable, yet she functioned within Charleston society and the elite St. Philip's Church community. Interracial marriage was not illegal at the time, just very uncommon. Whether they ever formally married is unclear. Barbara and Hagar both married into the free black community and prospered as businesswomen with connections to powerful white men. Both became slave owners. Barbara became involved in a famous lawsuit. She loaned money to a white planter to buy a plantation. He didn't repay, and she sued. As a woman of color, it was not surprising that she lost the suit. But she won her case on appeal and got her money. Her victory was only a tiny fragment of justice within a system built on injustice for non-whites. Race relations were complicated. The state's economy and social structure were built on the institution of slavery and the suppression of people of color. Yet here is this love story and a black woman's victory in court over a prominent white man. Section 1. The Economy and Everyday Life. As you read, look for the ups and downs of cotton production in the antebellum era, the classes of people in antebellum South Carolina, the importance of religion and the impact of the Second Great Awakening, developments in literature, the arts, science, and education, improvements in transportation and industry, terms, yeoman farmer, camp meeting, blue laws, states' rights, mill village. The wealth of South Carolina in the 19th century depended upon two staple crops grown on large plantations and exported to other states or overseas. Rice was still important, but the new staple crop, cotton, soon surpassed it as the state's main producer of wealth. Cotton could be grown on almost any land, and the cultivation of cotton took over agriculture in the upcountry. Food crops and livestock were raised, but only for local use. Cotton production and income from cotton boomed in the first two decades of the 19th century. The number of cotton gins multiplied and their efficiency improved from hand-cranked to steam-powered machines within a few decades. Gin efficiency was needed to match the demand of rapidly developing textile, cloth industries in England and New England. Classes in antebellum South Carolina. The cotton boom affected every class of Carolinians. The planters prospered. The slaves survived a brutal, forced labor system. The middle class of landholding farmers and most town dwellers made an adequate living, but the poor white class barely hung on at the fringes of society. The planter class. The planter class was composed of families who owned several hundred acres of land and at least 20 slaves. If you were a planter, you were likely to prosper. You had a large house, wore nice clothes, ate well, and owned horses to ride. You might get an adequate or even an excellent education. With a grist mill, sawmill, and blacksmith shop manned by slaves on your plantation, you ran a fairly complex business. Your prosperity was based on the labor of those 20, 50, or 300 slaves. South Carolina in the antebellum era was a differential society. The people of each class were expected to show proper deference, respect, to their betters in the class above them. At the top of the social ladder, you could expect members of all other classes to defer to you in social and business dealings. The code of honor was important to the upper crust. If your honor as a gentleman was questioned by your social equal, you might challenge him to a duel, a fight with weapons between two people following strict rules. South Carolina recorded more duels than most states. The slave class. Slaves belonged to a rapidly growing class as the cotton kingdom expanded. Many slaves were imported from farther north, especially Virginia. Nearly 40,000 slaves from Africa passed through Sullivan's Island in the 4 years before Congress shut down the trade for good in 1808. If you were one of these 40,000, you likely walked in chains to an upcountry plantation. Your sweat and labor produced the white fiber that made your owner richer. You made the tools, wove the baskets, sewed the clothes, and cooked the food, your African influence creating soul food. Creating a family was of great importance to you as a slave. Your well-being and status within the slave community depended on the productivity of your entire family. More importantly, the family provided the emotional shelter you would need to survive the cruel and dehumanizing qualities of slavery. Slavery was built on a foundation of violence or threat of violence. You were not paid to work, so your reason to work was fear of physical punishment. The family was your refuge and comfort. Your family might come to feel like its work had earned a rightful ownership to part of the land. Your wedding probably consisted of jumping over a broomstick with your mate, while your friends watched and celebrated with you, though legally the marriage was not recognized. The shadow always looming over the slave family was the fear that children or spouse could be taken suddenly and sold to another planter hundreds of miles away, never to be seen again. Your religion was, like your family, a refuge and comfort. In the 19th century, most slave owners actively tried to convert their slaves to Christianity. Religion kept slaves more contented, and it instilled the biblical teaching that slaves should obey their masters. You, as a slave, would more likely be drawn to the promise of Moses leading the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt to the Promised Land. In the Master's Church, you heard many sermons on the obedience theme. In secret services in the woods with fellow slaves, you talked a lot about deliverance. And you sang and danced and dreamed of a better tomorrow, either in this life or the next. The white middle class. Between the planter aristocracy and the black slaves were the majority of whites who generally fit into two broad groups, the middle class and the poor whites. The middle class consisted of artisans and mechanics in the towns and yeoman farmers, small landowning farmers, in the rural areas. If you were a yeoman farmer, your own farm produced most of your necessities. You did not live in great comfort, but neither were you threatened with starvation. You owned some farm animals, tools, and a barn or a couple of sheds. Your house was small, perhaps two rooms with a hallway between, with a fireplace in each room. A front porch gave you more living space. You grew your own food, corn, beans, okra, and chickens and pigs. But you devoted most of your land to growing cotton. You were selling cotton to factors, brokers, in Charleston, who sold it to buyers in England and New England. You were part of a world market that sometimes paid you well and sometimes did not, and you had no control over it. Your life, like the slaves' lives, was one of hard work. Farm work was heavier during planting and harvesting seasons, but there was plenty of work year-round. Milking cows twice a day, feeding animals, repairing tools and equipment, drying vegetables and fruits, and salting and smoking meats. Chopping cotton, cutting out weeds and excess cotton plants with a hoe, had to be done in the heat of summer. Picking cotton in the fall was perhaps the most back-breaking work of all, stooping to reach the low-growing plants and dragging the heavy bag full of cotton strained the back. Cotton bolls had sharp spines that pricked your hands, adding to the pain of the experience. A successful crop year might enable you to buy a slave or two. The slaves would add to your farm's productivity, but would not reduce your work. If you were a female, the slaves might relieve you of some field work and allow you more time to make and repair clothes, prepare food, and tend the garden, orchard, and animals. Operating a farm was a family affair. You prized your children not only as objects of love, but also as additional workers, and they took care of you when you grew old or became disabled. The poor white class. Whites who were not members of the planter aristocracy or the middle class could be characterized as poor whites. As a member of this class, you worked for wages on someone else's farm or in a menial, lowly job in town. Your wages were low. After all, you were competing with unpaid slave labor. You lived in a shack that was no better than a slave cottage, and sometimes worse. Widows and the children of widows were often the poorest of the poor. As a widow without property, you would have to take whatever scraps of work you were offered at whatever wage. You and your children might have to hope for charity. Charleston, Beaufort, and Georgetown had several social service associations to help the poor. Religion. All classes were affected by more than just cotton. In the early 19th century, a religious revival movement called the Second Great Awakening swept across the nation like wildfire. All denominations benefited, but the Methodist and Baptist grew the most. Slaves were attracted to the emotion-filled religious services and were encouraged by their owners to become members. The Beaufort Baptist Church, for example, by the 1850s, had 166 white and 3,557 slave members. The message of white pastors to their mixed audience was this: slaves, obey your masters. Masters, be kind to your slaves. The institution of slavery was not to be questioned. One of the long-lasting customs emerging from the Second Great Awakening for white believers was the annual camp meeting. Hundreds gathered for several days, lived in tents or small shacks on camp meeting grounds, and participated in multiple worship services. Ministers preached emotional sermons designed to convert the wicked and revive the faith of those whose enthusiasm had cooled. Camp meetings were great social experiences for isolated rural dwellers, young and old. Many marriages, as well as many broken hearts, no doubt, came out of camp meetings. The Second Great Awakening brought blue laws, regulations enacted by state and local governments to restrict activities on Sunday, many of which still exist. Buying and selling, playing games, engaging in sports, and doing non-essential work on Sunday were made illegal. The major religious denominations operating in South Carolina were national organizations with membership in all sections of the country. In the 1840s, first the Methodist Church, then the Baptist Church, split into Southern and Northern churches over the issue of slavery. During the 1850s, several other major churches did the same. This was bad news for the unity of the nation. Literature, the arts, and science. As the South, including South Carolina, isolated itself more and more from the rest of the nation, its intellectual leaders became more outspoken in their defense of Southern institutions and customs. Thomas Cooper, president of the College of South Carolina in Columbia, was a leading writer, along with John C. Calhoun, for the causes of slavery and states' rights, the belief that the rights and powers of the states are more important than the rights and powers of the federal government. William Gilmore Sims was probably the state's best-known author nationally. Famous for his historical romantic novels about the colonial era and the American Revolution, he also wrote a history of South Carolina for use in schools in 1840. Sims and other Charleston writers of the time, including poets Paul Hamilton Hayne, Henry Timrod, and William J. Grayson, were defenders of slavery and the South's rural way of life. South Carolina produced some great artists and architects in the antebellum era, but most of them left the state to earn a better living. Washington Allston, of the famous rice planters of Waccamaw Neck in Georgetown District, became one of the great American painters. He left the state as a young man and spent most of his artistic career in Europe and Massachusetts, painting romantic landscapes and seascapes. English-born Thomas Sully spent several formative years in Charleston, but most of his extraordinary career, which included portraits of Queen Victoria and Abraham Lincoln, was spent in Europe and Philadelphia. Robert Mills became a nationally known architect. Born in Charleston, he designed many public buildings and projects in South Carolina. He was important in the growing popularity of Greek Revival architecture, a style that imitated the architecture of ancient Greece. His buildings included 16 county courthouses, 12 jails, and many churches. He designed Charleston's fireproof building and Columbia's Ainslie Hall Mansion, commonly called the Robert Mills House, and South Carolina Lunatic Asylum. He also designed several canals, including one around the Rapids in Columbia. In 1830, he moved to Washington, D.C., where he had a distinguished career designing public buildings and establishing a style for federal buildings. His creations include the Treasury Building, the Patent Office, and the Washington Monument. The painter Charles Frazier and the painter-playwright John Blake White chose to make their careers in Charleston. Frazier is considered a master of miniature portraits. White specialized in painting large dramatic scenes from the American Revolution. Four of White's paintings are on display in the U.S. Capitol. He also painted portraits of prominent Carolinians, including John C. Calhoun and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. Scientists were exceptions to the isolation of South Carolina intellectuals. Several were well-respected in their fields and maintained wide connections to the international science community. Perhaps most famous were John and Joseph LeConte of South Carolina College. John was a chemist. Joseph was a geologist. Both were outstanding teachers and wrote highly respected scientific books, bringing great distinction to the college. John Bachman, a Lutheran minister, was an intellectual leader and naturalist, a person who studies plants and animals, often as an amateur, in Charleston. During the 1830s, he wrote the scientific descriptions for John James Audubon's beautiful bird paintings. Bachman also debated other scientists about the nature of race. Some argued that different races were different species. Bachman said that all humans were of one species. Even so, he strongly defended slavery. Education. Education in the antebellum era continued to be largely a family matter. The state government did not accept responsibility for educating children. Private academies were the norm. There were over 200 of them in South Carolina by 1860, and some of them were excellent. Early in the century, Dr. Moses Waddell's Willington Academy near Abbeville, or, after 1854, King's Mountain Military Academy in York, could prepare young males for South Carolina College, Yale, Princeton, or even an English university. Barhamville Academy near Columbia, Limestone Springs Academy in Gaffney, or Madame Talvonde's French School for Young Ladies in Charleston, could prepare young females in music, languages, and the arts. Learning these skills would make them more delightful companions for planters, lawyers, or businessmen. Most white families could not afford the private academies. Therefore, fewer than half the children in South Carolina in this era received even an elementary education. Charleston was an exception. By the 1850s, the city provided schools that were good and popular with all classes of white citizens. South Carolina's efforts in higher education were more vigorous and successful than at lower levels. Though the state's white residents were below average in literacy, a higher percentage of its population got a college education than in most states. South Carolina College, later the University of South Carolina, chartered in 1803, provided a good education within the state for a leadership class. The College of Charleston was mainly as a preparatory school from 1790 until 1837. Then it became a city college with a liberal arts curriculum. It enjoyed a good local reputation. Near the end of the antebellum era, several religious denominations founded colleges. In the early years, many were little better than secondary schools. The Associate Reformed Presbyterians established Erskine College in Due West in 1839. In the 1850s, the Methodists founded Wofford College in Spartanburg for males and Columbia Female College, later simply Columbia College, in the capital city. The Baptists created Furman College in Greenville for males and Greenville Female Baptist College, later merged with Furman. The Lutherans formed Newberry College for males in Newberry. The ups and downs of cotton. In the 1820s, the world price of cotton went down, and so did South Carolina's prosperity. The price decreased because the supply increased from the new richer soils of Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. In the first decade of the century, South Carolina was producing one-half of all cotton grown in the United States each year. By 1821, the state's production amounted to only 29%. Unfortunately, Carolina farmers and planters had not taken good care of their land. They grew cotton until the land was worn out. Instead of fertilizing the soil and preventing erosion, it was easier to clear more land and start over. Many simply pulled up stakes and moved west. Despite the low points, cotton continued to grow in importance in South Carolina and in the whole South. In the 1840s and 1850s, another cotton boom brought more prosperity. Senator James Henry Hammond warned the United States Senate in 1858 that no one should threaten the South or slavery because, quote, cotton is king, end quote. Harming slavery would ruin the economies of America and Britain, Hammond suggested. King Cotton was not a kindly monarch. In addition to rapidly wearing out the land, cotton resulted in a renewed dedication to slave labor. At the end of the American Revolution, many serious discussions questioned whether the institution of slavery went against the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the teachings of Christianity. Northern states gradually emancipated their slaves. In 1787, Congress outlawed slavery in the old Northwest Territory. Even in South Carolina, Quakers and the New Methodist Church expressed reservations about slavery. The state outlawed importing more slaves into the state for several years. After the invention of the cotton gin, however, King Cotton washed away any doubts about the necessity of slavery. A revitalized slavery. Slavery experienced a spurt of growth in the 1790s that continued throughout the antebellum era. By 1820, the slave population was again in the majority in South Carolina. Blacks were to remain the majority for the next century. By 1810, slavery was spread across all the state. Many of the smaller slaveholders lived in the backcountry. Most of the largest slaveholders were still concentrated near the coast. Nearly half the white population belonged to slaveholding families, the highest proportion of slaveholders of any state. The majority of slaveholders owned fewer than 10 slaves, but the majority of slaves were owned by the planter class, owners of 20 or more slaves. One astounding fact is that a few free blacks owned slaves, such as Margaret Bedingall Tunnow and her daughters. In 1860, 171 of the nearly 10,000 free blacks in the state owned slaves. Most owned only one or two. A notable exception was William Ellison of Stateburg in Sumter District, who owned 63. Ellison was born a slave, but earned extra money building cotton gins and bought his freedom. His profitable gin business enabled him to invest in land and slaves and become a large planter. He bought a pew in Statesburg's Episcopal Church and a fine home once owned by Governor Stephen D. Miller. The story of slavery and slaveholding in South Carolina takes many unusual twists. The Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution brought great change to Europe, beginning in the late 18th century. It shifted work from humans to water or steam-powered machines. Productivity skyrocketed. Large numbers of people worked outside of agriculture for the first time in recorded history. New England was the only section of America that developed much industry early in the 19th century. Except for cotton gins and rice mills, South Carolina almost totally missed out on the early Industrial Revolution. In this state, wealth and prestige had always come from owning land and slaves. Though the state did not become industrialized, it was still affected by the technological advances in Europe and New England. As those areas adopted power machinery to make cotton textiles, they needed more and more cotton from the fields of the South. Transportation. The magnificent river systems in South Carolina needed some human help to make them serve transportation needs more effectively. Canals were built to connect rivers and bypass rocky rapids at the fall lines in several rivers. The first and longest, the Santee Canal, connected the Santee and Cooper Rivers. By 1800, this provided easier access of upcountry products like cotton to the port at Charleston. The state government got excited about canals in 1818 and built several in the upcountry over the next 10 years. The canals improved river transportation, but the state needed a flexible system that could connect all the main towns to one another. The solution to the problem was the railroad. In the late 1820s, inventors began to experiment with steam engines on wheels that would pull cars on tracks. Charleston's leaders built a railroad from Charleston to Hamburg, today's North Augusta. It was 136 miles long, the longest in the world at that time. Completed in 1833, the railroad was a success. Within 3 decades, railroads crisscrossed the state and connected most of the main towns. By the 1850s, one could travel from Columbia to Charleston in less than 8 hours. Cotton shipment from the upcountry to Charleston and slave transport to the upcountry became cheaper. A little bit of industry. South Carolina's dedication to its staple crops delayed industry getting a foothold. William Gregg and others argued for a diverse economy, a mix of agriculture, industry, commerce, and banking. Few listened. Gregg's investment in a large Graniteville mill in 1849 was successful, but very few followed his lead. By 1860, there were 17 other cotton mills in South Carolina, all much smaller than Graniteville. For his 325 workers, Gregg built a mill village, a company-owned cluster of houses near a mill or factory, the model for many to come. He also provided stores, 2 churches, and a school for children under 12. He thought industry would be the salvation for poor whites. Pottery, an industry that had ancient roots, arose in Edgefield District. The area had fine clay and artistic potters. A slave named Dave produced some of the finest and largest pottery. Some held 40 gallons, very hot kilns, ovens used for frying pottery, at Pottersville, produced extra dense and hard stoneware. The containers were finished with distinctive and beautiful glazes. Dave was literate and often carved 2-line poems on his creations. If you find one of Dave's pots today, sell it and pay your way through college. Gold mining attracted some attention in the antebellum era. As many as 100 small gold mines operated in the South Carolina Piedmont in the 1830s. But the amounts of gold never equaled that found in both North Carolina and Georgia. All 3 states were totally overshadowed by California after 1849. South Carolina, unfortunately, continued to put almost all its eggs in the agriculture basket. Carolinians tended to see the movement of northern states toward more industry and commerce as a threat to the southern way of life. They felt the nation was turning against them and their institutions, particularly the institution of slavery. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, yeoman farmer, camp meeting, mill village. 2. What 4 classes of people lived in South Carolina in the antebellum era? 3. What effects did the Second Great Awakening have on South Carolinians?